Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Steve Grace. Steve is a local marine educator and a naturalist, and we'll be talking about a very special place near Steve's home, a lost wilderness right here on the Quimper Peninsula. So welcome, Steve.
Hey, Nan. It's great to be here.
But first, before we talk to Steve Grace, let's hear that mystery sound. I'll give you a little hint. Although an infrequent visitor to the Olympic Peninsula, this critter has been hanging out in Port Townsend's uptown neighborhood recently. And I know personally that Monica Fletcher, excellent birder, has seen it. Now to observations and news. Well, the AmeriCorps aquarium educator out at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, her name is Marley Loomis, reported on their low tide walk, which was held Monday, February the 18th at North Beach County Park. In just a couple of hours, participants found and identified 32 different species of animals and algae. The list included small decorator crabs, clingfish, tide pool sculpins, lots of kinds of sea stars, even a brittle star, and a small octopus under a rock. Quoting Marley, low tide walks and tide pooling are especially interesting because at low tide, a very special group of organisms becomes visible. The usually rocky area that one walks along at low tide is called the intertidal zone. It's the area that exists between low and high tides. It's underwater at high tide, but exposed at low tide. And because of the variability in water coverage, the animals that live in this zone must have adaptations that allow them to survive both in and out of the water without drying out. That's a quote from Marley Loomis. The Marine Science Center will schedule another low tide walk once the weather warms up a bit and the low tides move to daylight hours. Well, speaking of the intertidal and low tide walks, I first met today's guest, Steve Grace, on a low tide walk. It was sponsored by Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society, and Steve was one of the members as we explored the low tide in the summertime. Steve is the author of many books, including Dam Nation, that's two words, Dam Nation, How Water Shaped the West and Will Determine Its Future. Steve is a marine science educator and is currently working on a book that will celebrate the natural history of the Northwest Coast. And we'll be talking about a lost wilderness that Steve found right here on the Quimper Peninsula. I've not yet had the opportunity to go out with Steve to visit this special place, but I have seen some fabulous photographs posted on Steve's website. Steve, tell us your website.
That's tidesandtrails.org, tidesandtrails.org, tidesandtrails.org.
He's got photos of this lost wilderness. Tell me the story about how you discovered this treasure.
About 3 months ago, I moved from uptown to an area called Ocean Grove, which is out by Cape George, and I immediately started exploring my surrounding environs. I love wild country. I love especially trail running through the woods, and started kind of looking around to see what was there. And there's a patch of woods that's on state land right by my house, and it didn't look very promising at first. It was dense, crowded second growth. And I'm not a big fan of bushwhacking through areas like that, but I really wanted to find a path through there so I could get over to Cape George and visit my friends over there. So I persevered and just kind of kept wandering through the forest and sort of got beat up a few times in all the really crowded brush. But eventually I pushed through that and just kind of following game trails and exploring, and the forest opened up. And I was shocked to see trees that were enormous that reminded me very much of Old Fort Townsend State Park. And wow. I was very surprised to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just kept exploring. I thought, well, at first I thought, well, maybe it's a fluke. Maybe it's just a few trees that somehow escaped the saw and managed to survive. But eventually I found about 30 acres of old growth, remnant rain shadow forest.
So, Steve, 30 acres seems like a lot. It seems pretty significant for a patch of old growth. You describe some of the clues that you had to it being old growth, but in general, what are the characteristics that are the sets of characteristics that you use to really recognize it as old growth?
Yeah. So, Nan, fortunately, I got to take the Jefferson Land Trust natural history course, Tidelands to Timberline, which was a wonderful experience. As soon as I moved here about a year ago, I immediately started taking that class. It was a great way to get introduced to the natural history of the area.
It's a great class. I've taken it too. Yes.
Yes. And one of the things we learned there was this acronym called OWLS, O-W-L-S. And I think maybe Heather Harding taught us that, or Eric Kingfisher. But regardless, I remembered this acronym that we were taught when we see forests that might be old growth. And so O-W-L-S, O for old trees, W for woody debris, L for layers, and S for snags. And so I started looking around and doing that checklist. And I thought, okay, there are definitely old trees here because I saw Douglas firs with deeply furrowed bark that's indicative of trees that are quite old, usually a century or more. And some of those Douglas firs had the really thick, shaggy, corky bark of trees that might be several hundred years old. So I checked that old box, and then there was W for woody debris on the ground. Nurse logs everywhere, lots of dead wood on the ground. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so great habitat there. All those old trees decomposing, releasing their nutrients to nourish the next generation of life. And then, so that's OW, and then L for layers. So I looked at the forest canopy, and it had multiple layers, very complex, lots of different species, different age classes. There was a patchiness to the upper canopy where old trees had fallen and introduced light into the forest, and then trees were growing up in those areas in multiple stages and stories. So we had those layers, and then I looked for S, the snags, the standing dead trees, or what are sometimes called habitat trees, because they provide a tremendous amount of habitat for wildlife, even more so than living trees. And there were an enormous number of snags. So I checked all those boxes, O-W-L-S, and I was kind of on my way, and I thought, okay, so it, you know, this feels like old growth, and now I can do something that's a little more kind of technical or scientifically substantive. And then I started communicating that with, you know, with other people, with the Department of Natural Resources and with all my friends at, you know, Jefferson Land Trust and other local naturalists.
Yeah, so you took all these folks out there and they helped you.
Yeah,
so
you're,
we know for sure it's old growth.
Yeah, yeah. So I started reaching out to the experts,
you know,
all the naturalists that I'd met through Jefferson Land Trust Natural History course and just other people I'd met in the community. First of all, just having conversations with them and then, you know, bringing as many people as I possibly could out there to see it, to basically get some more, you know, expertise to have people who really know this stuff, who've been working on it their entire careers, to kind of give a more more thorough and professional analysis that this does indeed have old growth characteristics or is old growth forest.
You know, we know that old growth is important, but can you sort of review for us why old growth is important to the ecology of our area?
Yeah, so a healthy old forest like this, all the structural complexity of it, the forest floor that has that kind of pit and mound topography where all the old trees have fallen down and torn craters in the ground and, you know, made a very structurally complex forest floor, and the canopy has all that structural complexity, that lends itself to biological diversity. So areas like this are tremendously biologically diverse, and some species in particular have to have that kind of forest. One that I'm particularly interested in is the marble murrelet, a seabird
that
nests in old growth forest. And there's tremendous marble murrelet habitat in this forest because some of these trees are so old, they have those wide upper limbs that that seabird, the marble murrelet, needs to lay its egg. So
have you seen any out there yet?
Have not seen any yet. It's a little early now, but I'm hoping.
Yes.
Eric Kingfisher from Jefferson Land Trust and Ken Wilson and I, we've been bouncing around this idea of maybe doing a citizen science survey and taking interested people out there.
Oh,
and
cool.
We could go out before dawn and stand under some of the likely trees that look like they have promising marble murrelet nesting platforms and listen for that distinctive keer call of the marble murrelets. And maybe kind of gather some data that way and confirm that they are possibly in the area.
So who owns this property?
So this property is owned by the state. This is state property. It's managed as school trust land by the Department of Natural Resources.
Any idea how it, I'm going to use the word, how it escaped?
Yeah,
being
that's
logged.
Such a great question. And no one knows, Nan. It's really a mystery. And I've taken a lot of people out there, including a former DNR forester, Mike Cronin, who's an extremely knowledgeable person who's just taught me a tremendous amount. And he spent his entire, 30-plus years with the Department of Natural Resources as a forestry expert. And, if he can't figure out how this escaped the saw, then no one can. And
yeah.
So many experts. I mean, it's really just been an entire brain trust of all, dozens of people who are extremely knowledgeable, kind of looking at this and trying to make sense of it. No one really knows for sure, but for whatever reason, we've had this good fortune that this, somehow it still exists.
So is it protected in any way?
Right now, it doesn't have any official protection. And so after I found it, for a while, I kind of had it to myself, and it was nice to just explore it and enjoy this lost wilderness. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, all this beautiful habitat, all these old trees have a lot of value for potential timber revenue as well. So I called the Department of Natural Resources and asked them what the status of this is or what their plans are. And they said they have scheduled a harvest there. They are planning to harvest it in 1 to 5 years. So that was a little distressing. So then I kind of changed gears. Instead of just having this place to myself, I realized I have to tell everyone about this. People have to know what this is.
So there is a threat to this habitat and this special place.
There is, yeah.
Have you looked at options for protecting it? Is the state open to options? What do you know?
Yeah, it's complicated. So I've talked with, while I was talking with DNR, Department of Natural Resource Foresters, I also started talking with their Natural Heritage Program, and that's staffed by scientists who assess the ecological, biological value of properties, of state properties. And so they have designated this area, this stand, as a globally rare occurrence. It has a technical designation of a very rare forest association. And the association is Thuja Plakata and Galtheria Shalon. So that's Western Red Cedar and Salal, two relatively common plants. But in association, that type of rain shadow forest is very rare. So it does have that designation, but it doesn't have the high quality designation that would protect it from harvest. It also hasn't been officially listed as old growth forest. So there's some gray area there and some sort of ongoing confusion about what exactly the characteristics of the stand are and how it could potentially be protected.
Do you have a plan?
My plan thus far has been to introduce as many local experts to this area as possible and then hope that something will evolve from there. So it's still an ongoing process. The people I took most recently, just a few days ago, Fred Wyman and Ann Wyman, who I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Sure.
So they've been
great botanists.
Yeah, I really, really respect their knowledge. And I've been wanting to take them out there for a while. They were out of the country. They just came back. So I've been, I had them look at it and assess it. And Fred told me that he said basically at this point, the forest is functioning as an old growth forest, regardless of whatever human intervention there was there in the past. Because there are a few stumps out there. It's not absolutely pristine. There was some human impact there in the past, but the stumps are few and far between. And the way the forest is functioning now, it's essentially functioning as old growth. So it was great to get his confirmation, his expertise, basically stating that this is, and he also said that it's extremely rare on the Quimper Peninsula. It's rare statewide, but just in our little neighborhood, our backyard of Port Townsend here, it's extremely rare. So we know all those things now as far as how we can actually get this conserved and this 30-acre stand set aside and not harvested. That gets very complicated. There are some mechanisms in place. I mean, one would simply be convincing, having conversations with the Department of Natural Resources and having them assess it and assess its conservation value. And perhaps they'll be willing to set it aside and manage it as a conservation property while they continue to harvest timber on the working forest adjacent to that. This is a relatively small 30 acres of a larger 240-acre stand or parcel that they manage. So it's roughly 10%. Mm-hmm. So they could continue to harvest 90% of that forest and manage that as working forest and simply set aside this one small area for its conservation value. Another mechanism is called trust land transfer. And that's a state program that exists to transfer land of high conservation value out of the Department of Natural Resources management, and then that goes to local management. It goes over to the county, basically, and then DNR is compensated by being given land of commensurate value in a different part of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's one possible mechanism that's been used to preserve other properties like Quimper West and Gibbs Lake.
Yeah. Steve, one more question. We know it's important ecologically, these kinds of areas. I want to know why it's important to you, or why it's important to the community, or why is it important to humans overall that we have these kinds of places?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nan. So I see this as forests like this as it's a living museum. This is basically what the forest used to look like on the Quimper Peninsula before we radically transformed the land and changed about 99% of that old growth forest. This is the last remnant. It's a living museum so people can see what the land used to look like. It's also a living classroom, both for youth and for adults about like myself, where we can learn about the natural world and learn about how a forest functions when left to its own devices. It's also a living library and a living laboratory. There's a tremendous amount of information contained in an old-growth forest. The drug Taxol, which is one of the most important cancer drugs that we have today, came from the bark of the Pacific yew.
That's right.
From old-growth forests, and on there's so many technological applications that we get from living old-growth forests,
and probably lots that we don't know yet.
Exactly. Yes. And it's a living library of information for the future generations of scientists that will learn to ask better questions and have more precise tools. They'll derive more information and more technology, things we can't even imagine right now. That's why it's important to save for the future and to preserve in perpetuity for future generations. And beyond all that, I also think it has this element of being a living chapel or living cathedral. It's a place where people can go regardless of their spiritual inclinations or religious commitments and just feel a sense of peace and wonder and awe at the majesty and the power of nature. I think that's a very important attribute. I just recently took a friend in there who has stage 4 cancer, and it was really a powerful experience to be back there. And my favorite part of that stand with him and see how he interacted with those ancient trees and see what value that brought to him. So for all these reasons, I think preserving this last remnant of old growth rain shadow forest on the Quimper Peninsula is of paramount importance.
Wow, that's inspiring. So I have the feeling that although we're running out of time today, I think we'll have you back as the story progresses and we find out maybe a little more about this piece of property. So thanks for this intriguing story, and I am really looking forward to getting out there.
Thank you, Nan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now we need to hear that mystery sound again. Those were several of the many calls of the California scrub jay. That's the, quote-unquote, blue jay of dry lowlands, especially oak woodlands, throughout western North America. The California scrub jay is a rather large, lanky songbird, and it's got a really sturdy bill and a long tail. The back and tail are rich azure blue, and it's got sort of a soft gray-brown collar around its back and around the neck. The undersides are white, and there's sort of a broken kind of blue necklace. You can tell it from the stellar jays that are much more common in our neck of the woods, because it does not have a crest on the top of its head. And like many members of the crow and jay family, and that's the Corvidae, which, by the way, of course, is the same name as the Corvidae Press that's located out in Fort Worden, the California scrub jays are quite vocal, and they're quite social, and they're smart. They also have a mischievous streak. They've been caught stealing acorns from woodpecker caches, and some even steal acorns that they've watched other jays hide. When scrub jays hide their own particular acorns, they are usually checking around to see that no other jays can watch. Looking forward to upcoming events, and with Steve's help, what's coming up this week?
You can learn about the importance of the Western Red Cedar to salmon as part of the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe Speaker Series on Friday evening, March 1st. Robert Knapp, the Environmental Planning Program Manager for the tribe, will give the presentation at the Dungeness River Audubon Center in Squim.
And then on Saturday morning, that would be March 2nd, Shirley Anderson and Ken Wiersma will talk about bird anatomy and biology as part of the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society's Backyard Birder Class Series. And that's also going to be held at the Dungeness River Audubon Center at the Railroad Bridge Park.
To prepare you to help respond in the case of an oil spill, attend an all-day Hazwoper training session on Saturday, March 2nd. The class will be held in the Port Angeles City Council Chambers. For more information, go to the Tsklallam County Marine Resources Committee website.
And lastly, the North Olympic Salmon Coalition is looking for volunteers to help plant native trees along Salmon Creek, that's sort of in the Discovery Bay area, on Saturday, March the 2nd. This restoration work will help improve the riparian habitat along this critical Chum and Coho stream. Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. My thanks to our editing crew. Today's sound engineer is Nora Petrick. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, questions, or ideas. You can email us at naturenow, that's one word, naturenow, at kptz.org. Nature Now airs on Wednesdays at 12:05 and repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. And our ending music today is Right Smack in the Middle of Town by the Old Growth Quartet, an eclectic Pacific Northwest group with roots in bluegrass, country, and folk music.
Smack in the middle of town, the barber pole goes around and round. Wise men in overalls say it's a shame. Streets are dangerous, the people are strange. They can't quite figure out what's going down. Right smack in the middle of town. Right smack in the middle of town, buildings go up, houses come down. They fill up with slaves in a paper of chains, hide from the sunshine and they curse the rain. They race the rats around and around, right smack in the middle of town. Come a running. If I call, would you come too? Every day it's always something, good or bad, it's always better with you. Right smack in the middle of town, kids with bad haircuts hanging around.
One's got a tattoo of a red and green rose. One's got a bull ring stuck in his nose. One who ain't shaving yet, he's toting a gun. It's all being done in the name of fun. Right smack in the middle of town. Been sleeping in the alleys and all on the ground. The address is a P.O. box. Laundry list, a pair of socks. We'll live forever with the lost and found. Right smack in the middle of town.